Okay, that's ready. All right, let's begin. Okay, good.
Om Sahana Vavatu. Sahana bhunaktu saha viryan karavavahai tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shantihi chaitanyam sarvagam sarvam sarvaguhabhashayan yat sarva Vishayatitam Tasmai Sarvavide Namaha.
Good. Welcome to you all. Welcome also to the many students watching these, attending these classes online. We continue the study of Shankara's Upadesha Sahasri. I think in our last class, according to some comments, I caught some of you off guard with a very profound observation about these teachings. And in particular, one statement somebody commented about was when I said that to call Atma Sakshi, witness, was a provisional definition. How about that? Provisional. It's not a final definition. It's a provisional definition. And when I say provisional, I'll just remind you of a long discussion we've had before about how these teachings work in layers, stages, steps, like stepping stones. They're crossing a river on a bunch of stepping stones. So you leave the prior stepping stone behind when you proceed to the next one. In the same way, we leave provisional teachings behind when we advance to further teachings. This being not an introductory text, we have to be ready for shifting our perspective along these so-called stepping stones. And in particular, with regard to Atma, the reason that Sakshi is a provisional definition and not a final definition is because how many times have we said in this particular class that Atma is unchanging? You've all got that. I mean, that's one of the main topics we've got here. Your consciousness, the consciousness present in your experience right now, is absolutely unchanging. Of course, your mind goes unchanging like crazy. So active, the mind. But consciousness itself is absolutely unchanging. Tell me then, in the absence of your mind, like in deep sleep, like in samadhi, is consciousness an observer, a witness? Yes. What is you're only a witness if there's something to be witnessed. In the absence of anything to be witnessed, you can't call consciousness a witness. It's a provisional definition. And it's a definition that doesn't apply 100% of the time. So, Atma being unchanging consciousness is only provisionally called Sakshi, witness. And this is to transition into today's discussion. And today's discussion is about the nature of Atma, the first two verses at least, the nature of Atma being free from any qualities whatsoever, being free from gunas, nirguna. Guna, quality, like adjective? Isn't calling Atma a witness, isn't that an adjective? It is. So how can Atma be nirguna If Atma is sometimes a witness and sometimes it's not. By the way, a little bit of grammar here is important. A adjective is subject to change. Adjectives belong to nouns. Nouns don't change. Adjectives change. So consciousness is always the same, but its relationship with your mind changes. As we said in the last week's class, sometimes consciousness is seer, hearer, thinker, feeler of emotions, sakshi, and sometimes none of the above. That all of these then are adjectives or qualities. And what Shankara wants to show in these next two verses, how consciousness, Atma, your true self, is absolutely without any adjectives, any qualifiers, any qualities whatsoever. So with that introduction, let's pick up the thread. Vishayatvam vikaritvam, vishayatvam vikaritvam, nana tvam vanahishyate, nana tvam vanahishyate, naheyo napyudaneya, naheyo napyudaneya, atmananyena vatatah. Before seeing the details of this verse, let's introduce the commentator on this text often introduces each verse by giving a objection, a very common style of commentary, to presume that every verse is meant to address a possible objection, and then the role of the commentator is to tell you what that possible objection is. I'm going to make up my own objection today based on modern science, because neuroscience today is really working hard trying to understand what in the world is consciousness. And they themselves will admit they're not doing too well, and many of them are admitting that they're off on a wrong direction and that it's not something they can study. So let's just start with this opening question. What can science tell us about consciousness? What is it? TLDR? Is that thing? Too long? Don't read. is that the acronym? Yeah. So TLD, which means there's a short version. And the short version is, what can science tell us about consciousness? Nothing. So, but now I'm going to give you the too long part. So the too long part here is that, what does consciousness do? I'm sorry. Wait for everyone to get settled down here. Good. What does science do? Science observes. Of course, science being science, it doesn't just observe. Science measures. Okay? Measures what? What does science measure? Suppose a scientist is looking at a bunch of cells underneath a microscope. What are they measuring? So they're looking at a cell. How big is a cell? What are the parts inside the cell? What are the various kinds of cells? There are so many different kinds of cells. So the first thing the scientist is doing is looking at the nature of the cell, the qualities of the cells. We use the word guna for these qualities, but we're going to use the word guna in a larger sense as well. So, obviously, the scientist will not merely observe the cell, but analyze what type of cell it is, etc., etc., to qualify what kind of cell. Number one, qualify. Then number two, what is a scientist going to do? What did I say? How many cells? That's important too. How many in an organ? How many cells? How many cells in this part of the organ? How many cells in that? How do these individual cells give rise to structure? How do they give rise to function? So that's done through analyzing not a single cell, but a quantity of cells. Quality, quantity, and there's a third major thing the scientist is going to be observing, measuring. What is that cell doing? Is it just sitting there? Chances are the cell is engaged in some kind of activity. It's metabolizing something, it's excreting something, whatever it's doing. And certainly cells divide. You've all seen pictures of cells dividing. It's an amazing thing. So cells are involved in change in activities that take place over time. So what is a scientist measuring? Quality, quantity, and change over time. This is like a simplified analysis. This is a big topic, but I think this is enough for our purposes. So the scientist is going to measure what is the quality of that cell, what is the quantity of cells, and how are those cells changing over time. Let's apply this analysis to Atma. And that's what Shankara does. So if you say, what is the quality of Atma? What kind of Atma? Right now, consciousness. Is your consciousness right now, is it happy or sad? Is it bright or dull? Is it calm? Is it focused? Is it agitated? Of course, from prior classes, you know that all of the characteristics I've just described are characteristics of your mind, known to consciousness. Right? Brightness and dullness belong to your mind, not to consciousness. Happiness and sadness belong to your mind, not to consciousness. We've done this topic very extensively, so I'm not going to dwell on it any further here, so we can make more progress in this text. So, would you acknowledge then that consciousness has no particular qualities, and being qualityless, it has the ability to reveal all the qualities of your mind, all the details of your mind? So consciousness is neither happy nor sad, neither bright nor dull. It is, by the way, unchanging. It can't. If consciousness were happy, how does it change and become sad? If consciousness were dull, how does it change to become bright? So we're back to this unchanging consciousness once again. So that unchanging consciousness is free from particular qualities. So therefore, a scientist has nothing to measure. As if they could look through a microscope. By the way, you've heard my observation about this. If the scientist is looking for consciousness through the lens of the microscope, the scientist is making a huge blunder because he's looking in the wrong direction. He or she is looking in the wrong direction. Not down there. Up here. You get that. You know, we've given that example before. Okay, so consciousness has no quality to be observed or measured in a scientific way. What about quantity? So the scientist is measuring how many cells, how many consciousnesses. We've had this discussion several times. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I'm pointing at the computer. Not conscious. Anyway, we've had this discussion. How to distinguish one dimensionless consciousness, how to distinguish it from another dimensionless consciousness. Cells have edges. If fact, I think they're called cell membranes. So a cell membrane will divide one cell from another. Their membranes may touch, but they are individual cells because they are bounded by membranes. Is your consciousness bounded by a membrane? It may seem so. Skin is a kind of membrane. And it may feel, in terms of your perception, that consciousness is inside of the membrane we call skin. But we've gone through this analysis several times. What you're referring to then, inside of this membrane, is the reach of your sense of touch. Your nerve cells extend only to the top of this membrane. And I've given this weird example before. Suppose my nerves extended through the... I like this science fiction-y stuff. Suppose my nerves somehow, I took some medicine, some drug, that caused these nerves to get overexcited, and they actually grew out through my skin and into the fabric of this chair. How's that? Why not? Right? They're nerves, so you can somehow make nerves do anything. So these nerves grew out through my skin and into the fabric of the chair. If that were the case, when I touched the fabric of the chair, what would it feel like? I would have sensation there. So my consciousness can't be stuck inside this membrane of skin. That conclusion is an artifact, so to speak, based on the extent of our nervous system. Your nervous system is inside of this membrane, not consciousness. Consciousness is the analysis we've given before. How tall? How wide? Anything? Dimensionless. Okay? That which is dimensionless, by definition, has no edge or boundary, like space. If consciousness is dimensionless, it has no edge or boundary, then how do you distinguish your consciousness from my consciousness? There are not many consciousnesses. We've had this discussion before. There is but one all-pervasive consciousness manifest in every individual mind. We've had this discussion too many times, so we're not going to elaborate on it further. So what is a consciousness? What is the scientist measuring? Can the scientist measure the qualities of consciousness? No. Can the scientist measure how many consciousnesses there are, like the consciousness would measure the number of cells? No. Then the last thing is change. The scientist is going to observe how the cells function, how they change over time. How does consciousness change over time? We started off the class with the fact that consciousness is unchanging. It doesn't change. So the point then is, what does the scientist have to measure? You would say, kuch nahi, nothing, bilkul, nothing at all. And that's exactly what Shankara says here. All of that is just to explain the first half of this verse. He says that for Atma, there is no... See in the second line, nahi ishyate. These don't exist. It doesn't exist for Atma. What doesn't exist for Atma? Vishayatvam. The status of being an object with various qualities. Atma is not an object. Atma has no qualities. Nothing to be measured. Therefore, na vishayatvam. There is no objectness, no qualities with regard to Atma. There is no, in a second line, nanatvam. There's no manyness. There's no number to be counted. And finally, na vikadi tvam. There's no changeness, if that's an English word. Atma is not subject to change. Atma is unchanging. So, just before we move on, the scientists, neuroscientists, who are struggling to understand the nature of consciousness, do you think this might be a problem? There's nothing for them to measure. And science is all about observation and measurement. What will a scientist do if there's nothing to observe, nothing to measure? No qualities, no quantities, no change. So then what are they going to observe? What are they going to measure? What are they going to write down in their notebooks? I think so. Do scientists still use notebooks? Maybe they're using tablets or something nowadays. Anyway, I have no idea. So you get the point. And then Shankara concludes here, na heyaha na api upadeyaha atma. Therefore, atma, consciousness na heyaha cannot be literally accepted, cannot be grasped, na upadeyaha, or set aside. That this is an expression used a lot in Indian logic. And what it means is consciousness cannot be an heyaha, cannot be an object that you study. Nor can it be an object that you don't study. It can never be away from you. It can never be outside. So you can't study Atma, nor can you avoid Atma, because what illumines the scientist's mind? Consciousness. What can the scientist do to get away from that consciousness? You get the point. So na heyaha, na upadeyaha, consciousness cannot be grasped as a subject of study, nor can it be set aside for the sake of studying something else. It can't be done anyena, by something else, by some field of science, or by some individual observer or scientist or someone who's trying to measure. Nava, nor can it be done by itself. Atma cannot accept or reject itself. That's kind of unnecessary to say, but Shankara says it here. So, Atma is not an object that can be scientifically studied. There's nothing to observe. There's nothing to measure. And this idea is expanded in this next verse. Sabahya bhanta, sabahya bhyantaro jirno, sabahya bhyantaro jirno, janma mrityujaratigaha, janma mrityujaratigaha, ahamatmetiyo veti, kuton veva vibheti saha, referring to Atma. Atma here, ajirnaha, end of the first line. Jirna is that which is aged, that which is old, that which is decaying. Like, in front of your eyes. Those of you who have been attending classes here for a long time, before your eyes, I am decaying. It sounds very dramatic. It's true. What to say? Of course, it's equally true for all of you, right? It's not just my problem. We are all decaying nicely together. So Atma, however, is ajirnaha, undecaying, unchanging. Back to that. Atma is unchanging. And a very important qualifier here, sa bahya abhyantara, from two perspectives, atma is unchanging. From abhyantara, from an internal perspective, that is, consciousness present in your experience is unchanging. Your experience change, of course, but is it consciousness that changes or your mind that changes? It's just like the example I've given 1,000 times, watching the sunset. Is the sun moving down or is the horizon moving up? The sun isn't moving. The horizon is moving up. In the same way, is consciousness changing right now? Is your mind changing? It's your mind that's changing in this experience. So in this experience, consciousness is unchanging, abhyantara ajirnaha. Internally, from its own standpoint, consciousness is unchanging. Also, sabahya, sab means also. Also, bahya, from an external standpoint. Now, external standpoint is a little tricky to understand. This really shows how you can't understand one verse unless you understand the whole thing. You can't understand the part unless you understand the whole. And this, by the way, is one of the reasons that independent study of scripture usually doesn't work very well. Because if you haven't understood the whole, how can you understand that one scripture? Anyway, this is a good example, because bahya, the external standpoint, is from when you recognize, according to Tattvamasi, which is going to quote shortly, next verse, I think, Tattvamasi, atma is Brahman. Brahman is the substratum of reality, of all that exists. So from this external standpoint, the standpoint of all that exists, the substratum because of which it exists is also ajirna, unchanging. So from the standpoint of your experience, consciousness is unchanging. And from the standpoint of the world, understanding consciousness as Brahman, the underlying reality because of which everything exists, that Brahman too is ajirnaha, unchanging, from both these standpoints. And it's interesting, Shankara just so casually throws this in. This is a sign of a text not intended for beginners. If Shankara were writing for beginners, he certainly wouldn't do that. This is not an introductory text. Also, with regard to that atma, because atma is unchanging, therefore atma is janma, mrityu, jara, atigaha. Transcending, beyond. It is beyond janma. When was consciousness born? Well, an unchanging consciousness can't get born. An unchanging consciousness doesn't have mrityu, death, nor does an unchanging consciousness have jara, old age. So consciousness doesn't change, doesn't experience these cycles of life. And just interesting to observe in terms of our own experience, the consciousness by which you knew your experiences as a child, and the consciousness by which you know what you're experiencing right now, how much has that consciousness aged? So age is another one of those qualities that doesn't belong to atma. Atma is ageless, naturally so, unchanging, doesn't change over time. Age is a change over time. Atma is unchanging. Now Shankara concludes this line of thought with a really important observation. Suppose we just stop at this point and ask my favorite question. Many of you know, what is my favorite question? So what? So what? This is a very philosophical analysis that establishes consciousness is unchanging. So what is it to me? That's a very American kind of statement. What do I get out of it? What's in it for me? Right? This kind of thinking. Well, Shankara makes it very clear. What is, let me be a little bit more serious about this. What is the value of that understanding? Is it mere philosophical fluff or knowledge, or is it a teaching that has personal value? And you've heard me say so many times, these teachings are not philosophy. These teachings are a solution to the problem of suffering. So there should be some way that Atma being unchanging contributes to your freedom from suffering. And Shankara makes it very clear here. He says, Aham Atma iti yaha veti. Yaha veti, one who understands, Aham Atma, I am that unchanging consciousness. We have to put those extra words in. One who has personally, and when I say personally discovered, one who says I am doesn't mean in an abstract or conceptual way. To understand that Vedanta says that something called consciousness is unchanging, who cares? That's not Vedanta. Vedanta is, to use a word we've used before, Vedanta is atma-vichara, self-inquiry. It's all about you. So, it's not, is atma unchanging? Am I unchanging? Is my essential nature unchanging? So, one who says, Aham Atma, aham is a pronoun I. One who says Aham Atma, I am that unchanging consciousness, this is not conceptual or abstract, this is immediate, personal. It's true of your own self. And we can even say true of your own experience. Again, your experience goes on changing because of your mind. You can know that consciousness doesn't change, just like the sun doesn't move, horizon is moving. In the same way, consciousness doesn't change, your mind goes on changing. So one who knows, yaha veti, one who knows, aham atma iti, iti is our quotation marks, one who knows this, kutaha anu eva vibheti saha, saha, that person. Kutaha anu eva, anu after or because of kutaha, what? It's a question. Because of what would saha vibheti, would that person have fear? Due to what? It's actually an interrogative here. What would cause that person to be afraid? Knowing that your true nature is unchanging consciousness, what is there to fear? I've paraphrased, and now let's make that point clear. Knowing that you are unchanging consciousness, to be injured requires change, right? So your body can be injured. It requires some change. If your body were unchanging, of course it's not, but if your body were unchanging, you take a knife and pound it into your leg, but your body is unchanged like a rock. So that knife would bounce off of your leg. Very interesting, because your body would be unchanging. So that which is unchanging, like a body, if your body were unchanging, it would not be subject to injury. How about emotions? If your emotions weren't subject to being pricked, nice expression, if you didn't feel pricked, then you wouldn't be emotionally injured. If your emotions were like, that doesn't sound nice. If your emotions were like a rock, that's not helpful. Emotions are, thank goodness, emotions are not like a rock. You know, our little side point. There's a kind of vulnerability associated with the human condition. Our bodies are vulnerable, and our emotions are vulnerable. And that vulnerability makes us subject to lots of problems, obviously. But there's a flip side to that. And that is, our vulnerability as human beings gives us empathy for the suffering of others. Just to suggest this, suppose you were invulnerable, like that Superman character, right? You're invulnerable, so nothing could penetrate your body, nothing could prick your emotions, your body is like a rock, your emotions are like a rock, you are invulnerable. What would happen to your empathy? Empathy literally means the word compassion. Ko and passion. To feel what somebody else feels is compassion. That's literally what the word means. To feel what somebody else feels. If you are invulnerable, you're not going to feel anything. So, our vulnerability, as much as it makes us suffer as human beings, also makes us empathetic to the suffering of others. Now, the Vedantic solution to the problem of vulnerability is to recognize that while your body is vulnerable and your emotions are certainly vulnerable, consciousness is not. Unchanging. That which is like to go back to the rock metaphor. Of course, rocks are changeable, but over millions of years. If you could take take one picture of a rock every year. You'd have to take a million pictures and you would see that rock crumbling. But over the scale of a million years. And this is the idea. So the rock is not exactly unchanging. It's a metaphor. But consciousness is not even like the rock. Consciousness is utterly unchanging. That which is utterly unchanging is not vulnerable. So let me try to make this point. The fact that your true self is not vulnerable can make you comfortable with the vulnerability of your body and mind. Turns out to be a big deal, especially in the field of psychology, because many people are uncomfortable with the vulnerability of their bodies and minds. Uncomfortable with the vulnerability of their bodies, they don't want to deal with medical problems, and they try to dismiss the seriousness or need to deal with any physical problems, who cares? And similarly, emotional problems. They don't want, so many people don't want to be emotionally vulnerable because it's painful. You know, think about young people who fall in love. They end up suffering like everything because they're young. This kind of young love is fraught with all kinds of problems. So they're going to suffer like anything, and sometimes they conclude, I'm never going to fall in love again, right? It's too painful. I don't want to go through that again. Somebody who's had an unpleasant experience of falling in love with the wrong person. It happens a lot, as you know. So that person may decide, I don't want to be vulnerable. And he or she can try to turn off their emotions, which is to become dead, emotionally dead, to some aspects of life. It's unfortunate. You can understand that. Self-protection is a natural kind of response, but if you cloak yourself in armor, no one can get you, but you can't get anyone else. You can't connect to anyone else. There's like a coat of armor between you and the other person. It's a very psychological topic, but this is the point. And that is, knowing that you, and I like the simple language, knowing that you are okay no matter what, because Atma is unchanging consciousness, knowing that you are okay no matter what allows you to embrace your own vulnerability. You don't need all that armor. You don't need to be self-protective. That may make your body and mind more subject to harm, but it also opens the door to human relationships, and especially to empathy. So little bit of an extension here. I don't think Shankara was so concerned about such matters. He lived a very monastic kind of lifestyle. But you can see the importance of this Vedanta in dealing with relationships. Painful, difficult relationships. Okay, anything else here? No. Now we'll go on. How are we doing with time? Go on to the next topic. I think we can finish this. I can't read this. I'll read it here. Pragevai tad vidhe karma. Pragevai tad vidhe karma. Varnitvadirapohanat. Tadastuladishastrebhyas. Tattvam eveti nishchayat. Tattvam eveti nishchayat. Good. Well, I stapled this together. I can't read the line. Okay. Let me introduce this verse. In fact, the next two verses, I think, go together. And it's here again, we'll introduce a possible objection. Atma is unchanging. If Atma is unchanging, why does the karma kanda of the Veda prescribe so many different kinds of karma? Because karma is done for the sake of changing something. Why does it prescribe all these rituals? Why are you supposed to do all these rituals? And if you don't do the rituals, why are there consequences from the non-performance of those rituals? The point here is that any scripture that's enjoining karma assumes change. By the way, if you weren't subject to change, what's the point in doing rituals? It's like, what's the point in doing anything whatsoever? What's the point in coming to Vedanta class? Because mind is subject to change, right? Thank goodness. Consciousness won't change. But consciousness doesn't have the problem of bondage. We've had this discussion before too. Bondage belongs to the mind, and mind is subject to change, so there is value in coming to this class. But now what about all these Vedic rituals? If Atma, and here's a confusion, Many people think, in fact, in vernacular languages, atma is often used to describe the so-called soul that travels on after death to some heavenly domain or hellish domain or gets reborn. And this confusion is a huge problem because that which travels is subject to change. Not atma, of course, but that which is addressed by scriptures telling you to do rituals is subject to change. So this is the objection Shankara addresses here. What about all these scriptures that tell you to do all these rituals? If atma is not subject to change, how are all those rituals going to be of value? And if all those rituals, here's the bigger argument. If the rituals found in the Vedas are, what is the American word, bogus? How's that? If the rituals found in the Vedas are bogus, wouldn't the same be true of the spiritual teachings found in the same Vedas? If it's bogus at the beginning, wouldn't it be bogus at the end? Veda anta? At the end? If the Veda part is bogus, wouldn't the Veda anta part also be bogus? So it ends up being a fairly serious objection that do the Vedas have validity if atma is unchanging? And that's little academic, but this is the nature of our text. Shankara addresses that. He says, prak eva etad vidhehe karma varnitatvadehe, that's it, apohanat. Varnitatvadehe apohanat prak. We have to connect all these words. Etad vidhehe karma. Karma. And here karma means the rituals. The rituals which are etad vidhehe, which are prescribed in the Vedas, the rituals which are prescribed in the Vedas, these rituals have validity prak, prior to the apohanat, prior to the negation, the refutation, varnitva dehe, of prior to the negation of varna, loosely caste. So the rituals of the Vedas are prescribed according to your varna and ashrama, according to the caste to which you belong, and according to your stage of life. This is the ancient worldview. According to your caste and stage of life, you have certain responsibilities in life, certain dharma duties that need to be fulfilled. And some of those duties are ritualistic duties in nature. And Shankara is making it very clear here that those scriptural prescriptions for karma are only meaningful prior to the scripture's negation of varna and ashrama, caste and stage of life, for atma. Let's make the point. If the scriptures prescribe, if you belong to this varna and this ashrama, you have to do this ritual every day. Okay. Tell me, what is the varna of atma? To what caste or stage of life does atma belong? That's negated. Prakeva, in the earlier part of the Vedas, here order sequence is important. You know that there's the karma kanda followed by the jnana kanda of the Veda. The karma kanda, the earlier part of the Veda, is where these rituals are prescribed. Then comes the jnana kanda, in which atma is established as not having caste your stage of life. So the earlier part of the Vedas don't apply to Atma after the negation of caste and stage of life for Atma. And he says, this is it's interesting. It's like, what would be a good example? Suppose you are studying a math book and first introduces Euclidean geometry, and then in the next chapter, non-Euclidean geometry. By the way, it's not as complicated as it is. Do parallel lines meet at infinity or not? And I don't remember which is which. According to one geometry, they do. According to the other geometry, they don't. Don't ask me which is which, but according to Euclidean geometry or non-Euclidean geometry, they have different perspectives on whether or not parallel lines meet at infinity. So look at this. If you've studied one geometry, then you turn the page to the next chapter. You have to kind of set aside the rules established in the prior chapter. They don't apply in the later chapters. That's a pretty obscure example. I apologize. I couldn't come up with anything better, so you're stuck with that example. Anyway, actually what Shankara is teaching is just, I think, more clear on its face value. So the earlier part of the Vedas established the necessity for certain rituals according to your caste and varna. But then having done so, the next part of the Veda says, by the way, Atma has no caste or stage of life. Therefore, all the rituals established earlier don't make any sense at all for Atma. That's simple. And he says all of this it's all negated by scriptures. Tad astulari shastre bhyaha, established by scriptures, that shastre bhyaha, due to scriptures, such as astulari, Atma is astula. I don't want to spend a long time on this, but the quote, Shankara would just give one word of the verse, so talking about Atma. Atma is astula, it's not a physical thing. Anu, it's not a subtle thing or a small thing. Ahraswam, it is not short. Adirgham, it is not long. Alohitam, it's not red. Go figure. Asneham, it's not sticky. Achayam, it's not shadowy. Atamaha, it's not dark. And it goes on and on and on like this. Neti, neti, the negation of all quality. So that is the passage from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. And Shankara says, Tattvam eva iti nishchayat. When you finally get this realization, after the negation, what's left? By the way, tattvamasi, this is a big discussion, we're absolutely not getting into it, but tattvamasi is meaningful only after this negation. If you try this tattvamasi stuff without doing a negation, how can I be that? I'm stuck with this limited body and mind, how can I be that? No, negation comes first. Then tattvamasi becomes meaningful. Having recognized that Atma is utterly free from any qualities whatsoever, including the varna and ashrama, the requirements for rituals, Atma is free from those rituals. Then I want to include the next verse quickly, because it's connected to the prior verse. The prior verse has used scripture to negate this problem of the scriptures ordain karmas, and how can scriptures ordain karmas for Atma if Atma is unchanging. So this prior verse was based on logic, I'm sorry, it was based on scripture. He gave the scripture from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, a stula. Also Tattvamasi comes from the Chandogya Upanishad. Now this next verse shifts to yukti. First, Shankara gives shruti, scriptural basis. Now he's giving yukti, reason-based basis. Purva deha parityage, purva deha parityage, jatyadi nam prahanataha, jatyadi nam dehasyaiva tu jatyadis, dehasyaiva tu jatyadis, tasyapyevam hyanatmata, tasyapyevam na. So previously he used some scriptural base, he used scriptural quotations to show how even though Atma is unchanging, scriptures still are valid unless you're enlightened. That's basically what he says. Now he says not that's based not only on scripture, but based on reasoning. He says, purva deha pratyage, when you drop your physical body at the time of death, then what happens to jatyadi nam? What happens to your caste and stage of life? If you have no body, so the point is that caste and stage of life belong to the body, but after you die, prahanataha, they are negated. They are, what is a fancy word philosophers like, obviated. You've shown them to be meaningless after death. So, that being so, here Shankara is using logic now, not scripture, and it says Atma is independent of the physical body. The scriptures address someone with a physical body. You see where we're going with this. As long as you have a physical body, then those scriptures about Vedic rituals have some meaning. But when you are independent of the physical body, when you discover that your true nature is Satchidananda Atma, then you understand that, oh, those scriptural mandates don't apply to me as a pure consciousness. This is using logic. So, dehasya eva tu jatyadihi. These jatyadi, caste and stage of life, belong to the body alone, tasya, to that body alone, api eva hi anatmata, but they don't belong to Atma. Since Atma has no caste or stage of life, how can these scriptural mandates apply to that Atma? So these two verses, if you're thinking, it sounds a little obscure, but Shankara is so fussy about one thing, and I'll just end the class with this observation. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. He would never have used that expression, but the point is that you cannot negate the validity of rituals and then accept the validity of Vedantic teaching. So you're either both valid or both invalid. The Vedas are one body of knowledge. Is it valid or is it invalid? If you say the rituals are invalid, then doesn't that imply that the teachings are invalid? So Shankara is very fussy here about maintaining the validity of the rituals, because, and he says, just to summarize these two verses, the rituals are valid with regard to the physical body. They are not valid with regard to pure, unchanging consciousness. So Shankara is very fussy about that. And this will be a good place to conclude for today.
Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om Tat Sat.
All right, is that off? Yes.